This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. You may recall that this issue, this month's issue, is devoted to fungus and fungi. And so we've hit chapter 3 called The Fungus Within Us. Does the fungal kingdom hold the key to unlocking the next wave of advancements in cancer research? This was written by Langdon Cook. 2 years ago, medical researchers taking a close look at cancer cells announced they had found a strange and surprising neighbor, fungi. But these fungi didn't just live near tumors. They offered clues about how deadly the cancer might be. Candida yeasts associated with colon cancer were predictive of metastatic growth, while with gastrointestinal cancer, they correlated with poor survival rates. It's still too early to know if the fungi fuel the disease or if the disease is somehow incubating the fungi. But at the very least, these discoveries hint that there may be a new way to diagnose people earlier and better understand their prognosis. Initially, we were astounded, says Ilyan Ilyev, an immunologist at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York and one of the researchers who made the fungi-cancer connection. In addition to Candida, his team found several other fungal species that were associated with the disease, such as blastomyces in lung cancer and Malassezia, a variety of yeast tied to breast cancer. Part of that surprise for many might be because of another link between fungi and our health. Medicinal mushrooms are sold throughout the world in various forms, from tinctures and capsules to powders and teas. They sustain a $30 billion business that's expected to double by 2032, in part because of their cancer-fighting association. Even so, researchers are still at an early stage of understanding the true benefits of medicinal mushrooms. In 2022, scientists in India and Belgium published a comprehensive survey of peer-reviewed literature on the topic. While at least 32 species showed promise, according to the report, only around a dozen had been clinically tested for their potentially therapeutic properties. Mushrooms produce a wide range of chemicals not readily found in other organisms, says Walter Leighton, a professor emeritus at the Belgian University KU Leuven, who contributed to the report. Some of these naturally derived compounds interact with the immune system too, as the report notes, exhibit potent anti-tumor activity, meaning they might slow the growth of certain cancers or even keep them from forming. Species such as reishi, Ganoderma lucidum, and maitake, Grifola frondosa, to name just two, have shown promise in clinical studies. Though mushrooms are vastly understudied, Leighton and his team called them one of the best gifts of nature for new pharmaceuticals, if we can better understand them. This is the paradox of medicinal fungi. It's a mysterious realm that could help or hurt us. Understanding this difference and how best to harness what we're learning hinges on exploring a broader frontier called the mycobiome. Your body is certainly no stranger to good or bad fungi. The yeast in your stomach that helps regulate digestion? That's a good thing. The fungal infection on your skin that causes athlete's foot? Not so much. Among the trillions of tiny microbes that live on or inside each of us in a delicate balance, there are bacteria, viruses, and single-celled protozoans, all of which are part of what's known as your microbiome. Fungi are also included in that universe, but in recent years, researchers have assigned them a separate designation, the mycobiome, in recognition that these organisms work quite differently. Xu Neng, director of the Microbiota One Center at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, says our body's fungal community is a small but crucial component of the gastrointestinal microbiome in particular. But while gut fungi such as Candida, Saccharomyces, and Cladosporium are all fundamental to our health, they have also been linked to diseases. Candida, for instance, can overpopulate and cause dysbiosis, a disorder associated with many health issues, including colorectal cancer. In other words, good fungi can become too successful and run amok and turn into bad fungi. For Deepak Saxena, a microbiologist at New York University, the life-altering question is simple. Why do some fungi inhabit tumors? Saxena's research group was the first to identify fungi in pancreatic cancer, finding in 2019 that a Malassezia yeast can migrate from the small intestine to the pancreas and inhabit cancer cells. Saxena hypothesizes that the fungi's presence in the pancreas might be because of either immunosuppression or some other kind of altered environment that tumors help create. In lab experiments with mice, Saxena has seen the use of antifungal treatments arrest tumor progression, although plenty of research has shown that what works in mice often isn't directly transferable to humans. For mushroom experts, it's not as simple as using one thing to treat another, either. Ng says that traditional varietals like reishi and turkey tail, Trometes versicolor, have immune-boosting properties that have been shown to enhance the efficacy of chemotherapy. Numerous studies also indicate that many mushroom species do, in fact, contain anti-cancer compounds, including biologically active carbohydrates and terpenes that stimulate the immune system. Still, there are questions about what dose is most effective and whether any of these would work as a standalone treatment. In the meantime, there are no mushroom-based cancer drugs or immunity boosters on the market today that have been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. That makes any mushroom-related remedy sold over the counter with health claims essentially try at your own risk. For some people, however, that seemingly untapped potential has led them to seek another kind of guidance. On an overcast day this past October, near Port Angeles, Washington, Robert Rogers tromped through a shady wooded area, followed by a dozen intrepid foragers who had signed up for his specially guided tour as part of the annual Olympic Peninsula Fungi Festival. He pointed to a fan-shaped fungus the size of a half dollar growing on a decayed nurse log. Its earthen-hued bands resembled the plumage of a game bird. "This is what turkey tail looks like in the wild," he told the crowd. Rogers isn't a doctor. He's a self-described clinical herbalist and the author of The Fungal Pharmacy, a field guide to identifying mushrooms and lichens with purported health benefits. And he's one of many ad hoc enthusiasts who have compiled research about incorporating fungi into everyday health routines, often as a preventative measure. Most commonly consumed mushrooms, even though ubiquitous grocery store button, have phytonutrients beneficial to our health. When it comes to cancer, however, medicinal fungi such as turkey tail are not exactly assassins. They don't kill cancer cells on sight, he explains. They encourage the immune system to do the job. More specifically, Ng says, turkey tail has been shown to increase the production of cytokines, which aid the body's cellular response to fighting a foreign pathogen or tumor. Used traditionally for centuries, a chemical from the mushroom has been the focus of more than four dozen clinical trials to date. As for the connection between fungi and cancer cells, Ilyev concedes that he initially considered it to be biologically improbable, but he's since shifted toward cautious optimism about unraveling more mysteries of the microbiome. In another recent study, researchers at NYU, including Saxena, found that there are 20 distinct types of fungi that may someday be useful in distinguishing between people with cancer and those without, pushing forward the idea that early testing of fungi might pave the way for better diagnoses and treatment. Compare the potential advances of medicinal fungi to the advent of penicillin. One of the great fungi-based infection fighters of the modern age, it was discovered accidentally nearly a century ago after a physician let mold grow in a petri dish of Staphylococcus bacteria. Who knows what other connections we might find now that we've started looking. Next, we have Chapter 4, Growing the Future of Fashion. In the world of microtextiles, cultivation becomes culture, one handbag at a time. This was written by Gary Nathan, with photos by Phyllis Ma. In present-day Romania, a dwindling number of artisans practice what's thought to be a centuries-old craft. They search the forest for hoof fungus, which grows within trees and sends out shelf-like mushrooms a few inches wide. The fungus is pried off trunks and, with a sickle, shaved lengthwise into thin strips the color of gingerbread. Those strips are then hammered and stretched to form broad, felt-like sheets called amadou, which can be crafted into hats, bags, jewelry, and ornaments. These products are beautiful and eco-friendly if painstaking to forage for and create. As far back as 1903, Tlingit artisans in what is now the state of Alaska were crafting pouches out of a sturdy, mat-like material. A 2021 study in the journal Mycologia suggests that these mats were produced by the agaricon fungus, a hardy polypore native to old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. But again, the artisan's process was about foraging for materials, not cultivating them for mass production. Today, inside a 136,000-square-foot facility in Union, South Carolina, the biotechnology company MycoWorks is pioneering a more intentional and scalable approach. Beneath dim red lighting that resembles a dark room's, stacks of metal trays are arranged in tall columns. Large mechanical arms whirl about, ready to pluck them individually for close inspection by a small team of technicians who wear sterile suits and examine the contents with flashlights. Each tray is incubating mycelium, a mesh of fine filaments that, for fungi, are roughly analogous to a plant's root system. Mycelium is a structural marvel, simultaneously soft, dense, and strong, which makes it a great potential replacement for leather. Coaxing mycelium to grow in predictable ways may be a complex task, but recent advances in biotech have opened up a cottage industry for mycotextiles. The early efforts appear to be more ethical, environmentally sustainable, and efficient than the multi-billion dollar industry that is animal leather. And MycoWorks is just one of a wave of innovators, all of which are betting big that a better understanding of mycelium can redefine the limits of fashion and design. MycoWorks co-founder Phil Ross has been experimenting for more than 30 years with Ganoderma, a genus of fungi that grow a lot like hoof fungus in the wild. As an artist in his San Francisco apartment, he learned how to manipulate the fungi into a range of forms. In 2009, he constructed a tea house made of bricks that could be removed and brewed into tea. Ross first considered mycological-based construction materials, but an inquiry from a shoe company in 2015 helped him and co-founder Sophia Wang refocus on fashion. The material that MycoWorks now produces is called reishi, borrowing the Japanese word for Ganoderma. In recent years, MycoWorks products have been used in designer bags for Hermès and upscale pillows for Ligne Rosé. The low-energy operation starts with agricultural waste, like sawdust and bran, which is heated to eliminate any existing microbial life that might be competition for the fungus. Once sterilized, the substrate goes into deep-dish lasagna-like trays of varying sizes, says Ross. Then Ganoderma joins the party, digesting and growing through the biomass. In some cases, fabric can be added to the tray as a scaffolding for the mycelium to weave around, creating a composite material. The sheet of mycelium is eventually peeled off the sawdust block, and growth comes to a halt. From there, it can be tanned to yield a material easily mistaken for traditional leather before being crafted into, say, a purse or hat. MycoWorks CEO Matt Scullin, who has a background in materials science, praises the wet spaghetti structure of mycelium, which is composed of filaments called hyphae that entangle one another and branch off in tree-like patterns while leaving empty space between the cells. The result accounts for some of reishi's most appealing properties. It has a bit of a velvety touch to it, Scullin says. It has a bounce. It has an absorptivity to the oils and heat that emanate from your fingers when you touch it. While mycelium can be grown in mechanized warehouses, Anjela Hoytink, the founder of the Dutch company NEFA, short for New Fashion Factory, uses a liquid culture technique to create bags, crop tops, even lampshades. On a recent day, she held up a small black handbag as proof of that proprietary process. NEFA uses bioreactor tanks, basically a fermenting system similar to a brewery's, to concoct a mycelial slurry that is strained out of the liquid and then poured onto a mold to dry into any desired form. You can really design from the product rather than designing from the material, Hoytink says, flexing and stretching the bag's glossy black material that's somewhere between plastic and leather, almost reminiscent of licorice. Technically, the bottom of the bag needs to be the strongest, so you could say, okay, we add a little bit more biomass here so that it's thicker and sturdier. This basic process allows NEFA versatility with minimum labor. Most important, Hoytink says, is that the liquid culture process affords a freedom to experiment with speculative ideas. Because it's a slurry, you can add ingredients a bit easier, she says. The company's next step, she suggests, may be to infuse the materials with branded aromas or even skincare compounds that treat conditions like psoriasis. That's just one way these products may differ from standard leather. Both companies are thinking about their eco-footprint and the complete life cycle of their goods, too. MycoWorks reishi, for example, is fully biodegradable, allowing for a future in which disposing of an old pair of shoes might mean simply composting it. While larger companies hope to use fungi to generate wholly new environmentally friendly materials at scale, independent designers are exploring their potential to modify or break down the planet's extant heaps of discarded fabric. Helena Elston, a New York-based designer, was studying fashion in London a few years ago when she devised an ethical response to the waste in her industry. She finds an old garment or stitches one together with scrap material, sterilizes it, and then adds an applique of mycelium. Over the ensuing months, she'll watch as the mycelium wends its way through the material. Sometimes it selectively eats at the natural fibers and ignores the synthetic ones. Sometimes it swirls dye into eddies of startling new color. In past experiments, Elston allowed the mycelium to break down the existing material completely. It feels like it has this intellectual understanding that we as humans don't have, she says. The most beautiful pieces have come out of me not being in control. Maggie Paxton, a mycophile in New York who hunts new pigments on her foraging walks, treats silk gowns with mushroom dyes for the American fashion house Coach. Recently, she took earth balls, mushrooms that resemble old golf balls as if aged to a dull brown, and boiled them in a stock pot. She was startled to discover this dye turned her silk the prettiest petal pink, a color that might inspire a future collection. Many designers still seem surprised enough by the behavior of fungi that they talk as if they're collaborating with a vibrant alien intelligence. That's the whole excitement about the field in general, Paxton says. We have no idea what magic is lying there right before us. The goal is to keep finding out. Now we're going to move on from the world of fungi to a slightly larger world. This article is called Eye to the Sky. In Wisconsin, the world's largest refracting telescope is once more open to visitors. This was written by Bill Newcott with photos by Christy Hem Clock. Inside the dome of Yerkes Observatory, tucked along the shore of Wisconsin's Geneva Lake in the town of Williams Bay, it is emphatically 1897. The still rotating metal half sphere is dominated by an enormous, lovingly polished refracting telescope, a 60-foot long, 6-ton contraption with 2 40-inch lenses at one end and an eyepiece at the other. The thing is almost ridiculously fanciful. If an astronomer or visitor wants to look through that eyepiece, an operator flips an ancient switch and the dome's entire circular floor at 75 feet in diameter, one of the world's largest elevators, rises 23 feet to give the person access. Then, in a maneuver familiar to any backyard stargazer, the viewer takes hold of the massive telescope with two hands and physically shifts the impeccably balanced device toward the desired point of light. Ironically, the cost of maintaining all this low-tech equipment is dauntingly high. Today, as tour groups shuffle through Yerkes, it's easy to forget that the observatory nearly met with a wrecking ball after the University of Chicago closed it in 2018. They call Yerkes the birthplace of modern astrophysics, but when I visited the facility about 2 years ago, it looked more like a place teetering on extinction. The monumental telescope was draped in a thick, clouded plastic sheeting that movie gangsters tend to use to wrap the bodies of their victims. It was a humbling state for a precision device that was once a magnet for the elite astrophysicists and theoretical astronomers, Albert Einstein, Edwin Hubble, Gerard Kuiper, and Carl Sagan among them. But even as I tried to make out the telescope above, Yerkes was being reborn thanks to a $15 million facelift, inside and out, financed by a nonprofit group that took possession of the building in 2020. For the first time in more than a century, the observatory, including its 50-acre grounds, is open for public tours of its working space science facility. Over the past few years, Yerkes staff have been preparing for what they expect to be one of the busiest days the institution has ever seen: North America's total solar eclipse on April 8, 2024. Williams Bay will see 90.2% totality, and Wisconsinites who don't want to drive hundreds of miles to witness complete darkness could find no more compelling a setting for near totality than here beneath these storied domes. But the glories of Yerkes are not confined to the heavens. The building itself is a thing of beauty. Festooned with elaborate Victorian-era stone carvings, Romanesque arches, and terracotta figures, the landmark observatory was created by George Ellery Hale and Charles Tyson Yerkes, two men with very different agendas. Hale, an astrophysicist, had the then revolutionary notion to establish a facility that housed both an observatory and an academic institution at which physicists and chemists applied their discoveries to new theories about astrophysics. Financier Yerkes, on the other hand, was one of Chicago's most hated businessmen. He poured money into the observatory to rehabilitate his image, but it didn't work, and he ended up moving to New York. Yerkes' face, however, is depicted on the observatory's exterior columns, albeit with a sinister smile and devilish horns. The artists had fun with that, notes Dennis Coys, executive director of the Yerkes Future Foundation, which inherited the observatory from the university. Nobody liked Yerkes, he says. The telescope's 500-pound lens, cast in France, ground in Massachusetts, made the instrument the biggest ever version of the handheld two-lens direct view telescope used by Galileo in 1609. Because Yerkes was one of the first large telescopes designed for photography, its tube needed to rotate with absolute precision to follow star tracks, a feat accomplished by a team of men who turned the gargantuan device one click at a time. Even after reflector telescopes, which use mirrors to collect and focus light, became the favored tool for space studies, Yerkes' staff continued to publish influential papers. Its archives hold thousands of research works, including Hubble's original 1920 doctoral thesis. In 2018, the university began winding down its Yerkes presence. Astronomers comparing present-day star positions with where they were a century ago still referenced Yerkes' 175,000 photographic plates, but the halls, once bustling with scientists, fell silent. When the call went out to support the restoration project, the influx of cash from astronomy and architecture enthusiasts across the United States, including many from the neighboring town of Lake Geneva, for nearly 200 years a playground of the Chicago rich, was overwhelming. "People have always wanted to visit here," Coyce says. "That almost mystical appeal persists today, whether visitors are star buffs or not. There's something about looking directly into a beam of light that has traveled millions of light years just to end up at the back of your eyeball." Finally for this week, we have an article called "Bugs on the Move." An innovative technique reveals the flight paths of insects in surprisingly artful ways. The images here are by Javi Bu. First, we'll read the text by Annie Roth. "The small bodies and speedy movements of flying insects make them tough to track. But technological advances and some creative thinking have allowed Spanish photographer Javi Bu to do just that. After spending 10 years concentrating on birds in flight for his Ornithographies project, he shifted his focus to bugs. For Entomographies, he uses high-speed video footage taken by Adrian Smith, an entomologist at North Carolina State University, to decode and document insect trajectories. Then, Bu selects multiple frames and merges them into single images that convey the rapid motions through space and time of one or more animals. With Smith's help, Bu has mapped the aerial acrobatics of wasps, the leaps of leafhoppers, and the flutters of butterflies in stunning detail. In doing so, he hopes to raise awareness about the decline of key insect populations worldwide. It's happening in front of our eyes, and we are not paying attention," Bu says. The results that are pictured here include the zebra longwing. This butterfly lives up to its name. The insect can soar to great heights with just a few beats of its supersized wings. The photograph looks like sort of a long ribbon that's all crumpled up upon itself. We also see the multicolored Asian lady beetles flight, and they look sort of like ferns or maybe corals. The two-lined spittlebug, an insect native to the eastern United States, has spring-loaded hind legs that can launch it into the air like a rocket. And it does look as if it's resting on those hind legs, but it looks more like maybe ribbon candy. And finally, the yellow-collared scape moth looks like the most beautiful multicolored ribbon with serrated edges that you could hope to see. With that, I need to leave you for the week. I hope you'll tune in again next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Thanks for listening.